Hello and welcome to ITE 1, Module 12, Part 1 for Semester 2. As with the last chapter, this is a rather big module and we are almost assuredly not going to be getting through it all today. And so that's why we will be doing this again tomorrow. So Chapter 12 today is all about operating systems. We've hit a lot about operating systems in Chapter 5, but we get even more in Chapter 12 because they're talking about some advanced topics that we didn't before. So review, what is an operating system? An operating system is the interface between the user and the computer. Without an operating system, the user would not be able to interact with the hardware or software on the computer. You'd have a really expensive brick, basically, is what you'd have. An operating system performs the following tasks and offers these benefits. It provides a bridge between the hardware and applications, creates a file system to store data, manages applications, and interprets user commands. Various brands of operating systems are available on the market today, including Microsoft Windows, Apple macOS, Unix, and Linux. A technician must consider the current computer and network when selecting an operating system for a customer. Additionally, there are several versions or distributions of an operating system. Can anyone name some versions of Windows that are out there?
Windows 95?
Sure, okay. 7, that's a more modern answer. Yeah, so you have Windows XP, Windows Vista, Windows 7, things like that. What about some of the different editions of the operating systems, like Vista or 7? What are some of the editions of those?
Starter, Professional,
Home.
Absolutely.
What is it, Vista Home Premium?
Starter, Home Basic, Home Premium, Ultimate, Professional. There's a bunch. There's a lot of them. Although apparently there were even more editions of XP. There were more XPs that people didn't know about. Okay, the various editions look and behave in a similar way, but some features needed by your customer may not be included in all of them. And we'll come back to more of this a little bit later. You need to be able to compare and contrast operating systems in order to choose the best one based on what your customers' needs are. Operating systems have minimum requirements for hardware. Make sure that your customer's hardware meets these requirements. The best place to check the minimum hardware requirements for an operating system or application is the manufacturer's website. A network operating system, NOS, is an operating system that contains additional features to increase functionality and manageability in a network environment. Some examples include Windows 2000 Server, Windows 2003 Server, Windows 2008 Server isn't mentioned in the curriculum, but it's out now, Unix, Linux, Novell NetWare, and Mac OS X. The NOS is designed to provide network resources to clients such as server applications, such as shared databases, centralized data storage, directory services that provide a centralized repository of user accounts and resources on the network, such as Active Directory, network print queue, and network access and security, and redundant storage systems such as a RAID and backups. Protocols used by network operating systems provide services such as web browsing, file transfer, name and resolution, and automatic IP addressing. Okay, so let's go into your chat windows because we're going to do a matching activity. Yay! Alright, so which protocol do you guys think this is? Defines how files are exchanged on the web. Which one do you think that is? Actually, somebody can just yell it out if you want.
FTP or file transfer protocol?
Nope.
Nope, not quite. Try again.
Well done.
That's better, yes. Provide services for file transfer and manipulation. Which one is that?
FTP.
That's your FTP right there. There we go. Okay, which of these protocols retrieves email messages from an email server?
That would be POP.
That's correct. IMAP as well, yeah. At this point it says
sure
POP,
which.
But IMAP is also... they both work. Okay. Which protocol resolves URLs to IP addresses?
Yeah.
TCP IP.
Drew, I think you actually had it right.
I wouldn't have said it converts URLs into IP addresses. I would have said host names into IP addresses.
Yeah, well, that's it doesn't, what it does here is resolves URLs to IP addresses. You're right, it is host names.
Because last time I checked, there wasn't an IP address for /data/files/project/web/public/google.html.
Yeah, well, that was what they had written there, so. All right, which one is it that automates the assignment of IP addresses?
DHCP.
That's correct. All right, thanks for that. We're done with the matching activity now. Thanks for that, guys. Sorry if that's a bit tedious, but I thought it would be a little fun. Now we are going to talk about file structures of operating systems. During installation, the Windows Setup program creates directories that have specific purposes. There are directories designed to store the system files, user files, and program files. When files of the same type are saved to a certain location, it is easy for users to find them. Actually, some of these files users probably shouldn't be finding, some of the system files. Okay, user file locations. By default, Windows stores most of the files created by the user in the folder /documents/settings/username/mydocuments. The My Documents folder contains folders for music, videos, websites, and pictures, and probably documents as well. Many programs also store specific user data here. A separate My Documents folder is created for each account on a computer. So if you have 5 people in your house that all share a computer locally, they're going to have their own My Documents accounts or folders. When the Windows operating system is installed, all of the files that are used to run the computer are located in the folder /Windows/WinNT/System32 if you're talking about Windows 2000, or /Windows/System32 for Windows XP, Vista, and 7, I assume. The Fonts folder contains all of the fonts that have been installed in the computer. Fonts come in several formats, including TrueType, OpenType, Composite, and PostScript. Font typefaces are the fonts that you can choose from within programs. Some examples of font typefaces are Arial, Times New Roman, and Courier. The Fonts folder can be accessed through the Control Panel, and fonts can be installed using the File Install New Font menu. So you go to File, you go to Install New Font. All of the installed fonts are located in /Windows/Fonts. For XP and Vista. Would that be under NT for 2000 as well? I'm not quite sure. The text got me confused a little bit there.
I wasn't paying attention.
Okay, if you're talking about fonts, in Windows 2000 they would be /WinNT/fonts, right?
Everything under Windows NT and Windows 2000 is stored under /WinNT. Everything under 95, 98, Millennium, Vista, and 7 is under /Windows.
Okay. All right. Temporary files. The temporary files folder contains files created by the operating system and programs that are needed for a short period of time. For example, temporary files might be created while an application is being installed to make more RAM available for other applications. Temporary files are found in the folder /documents/settings/username/local/settings/temp for XP. And in Vista, they're in a little bit different places, and we'll come to that in a little bit here.
They're also found by typing %temp% in the run box, at least in XP.
Yeah, that would be a good way to do it, because you'd get the environment variable. That's a good way to do it. I'd never thought about doing it that way. I'll have to try that. The Program Files folder is used by most application installation programs to install software. In fact, very few of them now are putting stuff places other than C program files, but when they do put stuff on the root, it makes me a little annoyed because I don't want them there. Programs are usually installed in the folder C Program Files. With Windows 2000, a new feature to help mobile users be more productive was introduced. Offline files and folders allows you to select shared files and folders from the network to be stored on your computer. These files are available after the computer is disconnected from the network. When you reconnect to the network, the changes that you have made offline are automatically applied to the original files on the network. If you want to know how to set up and view these offline files and stuff, there's a whole section here about it. And it's really cool. But it's something that you guys can read about on your own.
We had a question last night.
Not in the test.
In some ways.
We did have a question last night as to, does anybody even use that offline file stuff? Well, yeah, try you having your computer without internet access. Yeah, I know that's a scary thought, but so there are some places in the world, not Mount Everest, that is, but there are some places in the world where you don't get internet. And if you are working on a whole lot of stuff, offline files is an easy way to keep them synchronized.
Okay, do I need to know how to... Do I need to go ahead and go through how that's done, or...
No, I wouldn't think so.
You guys to read it. Okay. For most users, in a home or small office, a default install of Windows is fine, so that just the typical install that doesn't do very much, doesn't ask you very much. A custom installation of Windows XP is typically used in a larger network. A default installation requires little input from you. You are prompted to provide information for the specific computer and the owner or user. Windows XP has only two additional screens for a custom installation. The first to customize the regional settings, and the second to customize the network settings. You can perform a custom Windows XP installation on more than one computer on a network by using an answer file that contains predefined settings and answers to the questions that are asked by the wizard. The technician can automate the customize a Windows XP installation to include the following features. You can have productivity applications such as Microsoft Office, custom applications, support for multiple languages, OS deployment feature pack using Microsoft System Management Server, SMS, and hardware device drivers. This next section is going to actually talk about how we would perform it instead of just talking about how to do it. So here we go. A custom installation of Windows XP can save time and provide a consistent configuration of the operating system across computers on a large network. This is so that we can have one setup that can be used on all computers so that we don't have to run an install from CD for every single one, which would take a ridiculous amount of time. I don't even want to think about that. There are several different types of custom installations of Windows XP that we can use to smooth this out a bit. They are an unattended installation from a network distribution point, uses an answer file, an image-based installation using sysprep and disk imaging program copies... I'm sorry, let me try that again. An image-based installation using sysprep and a disk imaging program copies an image of the operating system directly to the hard drive with no user intervention. A remote installation using remote installation services, or RIS, downloads the installation across the network. This installation can be requested by the user or forced onto the computer by the administrator. An OS deployment feature pack using Microsoft SMS dramatically simplifies deployment of an operating system across the organization. And the server, it can also dramatically decrease the wallet of said organization because this is not a very cheap way of doing things. Unattended installation uses an unattend.txt answer file and is the easiest custom installation method to perform on a network. An answer file can be created using an application called setupmgr.exe located within the deploy.cab file on the Windows XP media, and it's in a different place in Vista, and we'll talk about that in a second. There is a fantastic description of a diagram that's shown in this section that shows an example of an answer file, and I highly recommend you read it. It was quite fascinating. After you have answered all of the questions, the unattend.txt file is copied to the distribution shared folder on a server. At this point, you can do one of two things. You can run the unattend.bat file on the client machine. This prepares the hard drive and automatically installs the operating system from the server over the network. Or you can create a boot disk that boots up the computer and connects to the distribution share on the server. Run the bat file to install the operating system over the network. Unattended installation in Windows Vista. To customize a standard Windows Vista installation, the System Image Manager, or SIM, is used to create a setup answer file. And this thing sounds pretty cool the way it works. The Windows SIM allows you to perform the following operations.
Is it worth mentioning it's 1.5 gig in size?
Oh, wow.
Just thought I'd mention it. Yeah.
That includes Windows 2, right?
Yeah. No.
I don't think it does. Otherwise, I think Carrie would have specified. Okay. Anyway, this thing is still pretty cool because it allows you to create an unattended answer file, obviously. It also allows you to update an unattended answer file, add packages such as applications or drivers to an unattended answer file, and validate an unattended answer file. So that adding stuff is pretty cool.
If you're using Windows XP, just for people to come back and look it up themselves, you'd want Nlight. It will do all of that for you for Windows XP.
That is correct. I don't remember if we talked about that much in Chapter 5. The course doesn't really talk much about it, but as blind people, it's one of the easier ways to do installation, so I think we did touch upon it. I believe we did last term as well, if you want to go back that far into the recordings. The Windows SIM is part of the Windows Automated Installation Kit, AIK, and can be downloaded from the Microsoft website, and is apparently that mammoth download that Gary was talking about. When performing image-based installations, begin by completely configuring one computer to an operational state. Next, run the sysprep to prepare the system for imaging. A third-party drive imaging application prepares an image of the completed computer, which can be burnt onto a CD or DVD. I would think you would want to have it on a DVD with as big as these are getting now.
I'd strongly recommend Image for Windows. It's cheap and it works, and there's a Linux version that talks with speech.
I have heard good things about it, yes.
And if you've got an external speech synthesizer, you can actually use Image for Windows. And if you don't, when you boot the Image for Windows disk, you can SSH in and drive it from a terminal emulator. So fear not, people who do not have hardware speech.
That's pretty cool. I figured there would be a solution that you'd be able to pop out with.
I didn't realize that until I read the book, and then it's like, oh, SSH in to the IP address. I'm just like, ah, duh.
Yeah, if you know how to do that, that's good. Anyway, this image that's been created can then be copied onto computers with compatible hardware access layers, or HALs. I think that's actually supposed to be a hardware abstraction layer. I think they got the acronym wrong, but anyway. If they have compatible HALs to complete the installation of multiple computers. After the image has been copied, you can boot up the computer, but you may have to configure some settings such as the computer name and domain membership. With RIS, Remote Installation Service, the process is very much like an image-based installation, except you do not use a drive imaging utility. You can use RIS to remotely set up new Microsoft Windows computers by using an RIS network share folder as the source of the Windows operating system files. You can install operating systems on remote boot-enabled client computers. Is that the thing that uses PXE boot, Carrie, that we were talking about a little while ago?
Yeah, it's a challenge to get running.
Yeah, I mean, if it goes, theoretically, the network card can tell the computer to wake up and you'll have network access as soon as you boot, but it doesn't sound like it'd be very easy to do.
It's got a few challenges. If you're interested in that sort of stuff and you don't have the money for Microsoft's implementation, have a look on unattended.sourceforge.net. There's all sorts of stuff there to do remote deployments and stuff.
Oh, okay, cool. User computers that are connected to the network can be started by using a remote boot disk or network adapter capable of booting the computer. That was the PXE boot thing, is the network adapter has to be able to do that. The client then logs on with valid user account credentials. RIS is designed to be used in a relatively small network and should not be used over low-speed links of a WAN or wide area network. Finally, Microsoft SMS allows a network administrator to manage large numbers of computers on a network. SMS can be used to manage updates, provide remote control, and perform inventory management. An optional feature is operating system deployment, which requires the installation of the SMS OS deployment feature pack on the Windows 2003 server. That's a mouthful there. SMS allows the installation of a large number of client computers across an entire network concurrently. Within the operating system, disks and directories are locations where data is stored and organized. Okay? The file system used by the operating system determines additional factors that affect storage, such as partition size, cluster size, and security features. A hard disk is divided into specific areas called partitions. Partitions are formatted so that they can store information. The disk management utility displays information and performs services such as partitioning and formatting disks in Windows. There are several types of partitions on a hard drive. Primary partition, this is usually the first partition. A primary partition cannot be subdivided into smaller sections. There can be up to 4 partitions per hard drive. Active partition, this partition is used by the operating system to boot the computer. Only one primary partition can be marked active. You can still have 3 other primaries, but only one of them can be marked active at a time. Extended partition, this partition normally uses the remaining free space on a hard drive or takes the place of a primary partition. There can be only one extended partition per drive, and it can be subdivided into smaller sections called logical drives. So those are the different types of partitions. And as said before, at any given time, you can only designate one partition as the active partition. The operating system uses the active partition to boot up the system. The active partition must be a primary partition as well, as discussed earlier. In most cases, the C: drive is the active partition and contains the boot and system files. Some users create additional partitions to organize files or to be able to dual boot the computer. There are several ways to access the disk management utility in Windows XP. You can select Start, right-click My Computer, then click Manage, and choose Disk Management from the window that comes up. Select Start, Settings, Control Panel, Administrative Tools, Computer Management, and then in the Computer Management window, select Disk Management. And that's the way that I'm most familiar with, and some of you that have done this before have probably used a little bit more often. Although the first one does sound quicker. There are several ways to access the Disk Management utility in Windows Vista, and they actually seem fairly similar. Select Start, right-click Computer, click Manage, and then select Disk Management. Select Start, Settings, Control Panel, Administrative Tools, Computer Management. Continue, because you for the user access user account control, and then click and then select Disk Management.
There's a third
Windows,
one. Which works all the way from 2000 all the way through to 7. This one works. Start Run, Disk MGMT.msc. Will pull you straight into the disk management snap-in.
I knew there had to be something, I just couldn't remember what it was. And now, of course, I remember seeing that and feel completely dumb.
Well, no.
Oh, I wish I'd have remembered it, though, because it's one of those things I'd love to be able to pop out with.
The interesting thing is that where I find all these weird and wonderful start-run things is in all the Microsoft knowledge-based documents. It's like, oh, you can go start-run and this string I've never seen before, and that gets you in there. It's like, oh, and apparently there's a way of throwing up the safely eject dialogue too by doing it that way, but I don't know how to do it.
Somebody made cool. A batch file once that did it for me, but I don't.
I think most of them, if you just do dir, or you just look up all the executable files in Windows directory or in path, you'll find a lot of that stuff.
No, that doesn't. No, that won't, because some of them aren't done that way. Because some
like
of them
the
are
CTL
inexecutable,
file.
But then they have to have an argument. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, the MSC stuff. Mm-hmm.
In Windows, letters are used to name the drives. A Windows computer can have up to 26 physical and logical drives because there are 26 letters in the English alphabet. However, drives A and B are reserved for floppy disk drives, and drive C is reserved for the primary active partition. Therefore, the maximum number of additional drives is 23. With the NTFS file system, a drive can be mapped to an empty folder on a volume and is referred to as a mounted drive. And Carrie sort of explained this a little bit earlier. The text will explain it again. Mounted drives are assigned drive paths instead of letters and are displayed as a drive icon in Windows Explorer. Use a mounted drive to configure more than 26 drives on your computer or when you need additional storage space on a volume. To mount a volume in Windows, 1. Select Start, Control Panel, Administrative Tools, Computer Management, and then click Disk Management, or you can do Start Run Disk MGMT.msc, as Carrie said, and you'll get it that way. Number 3, right-click the partition or volume to be mounted. Click Change Drive Letter and Paths. 5, click Add. 6, click Mount in the following empty NTFS folder, and I'm thinking it's probably a radio button in there. 7, create an empty folder. Type the path to an empty folder or browse to an empty folder on an NTFS volume and click OK. Finally, 8, close computer management. The disk management utility displays the status of each disk. The hard drives in the computer will display one of the following conditions. And there's a few of these here. Foreign, a dynamic disk that has been moved to a computer from another computer running Windows 2000 or Windows XP. Healthy, a volume that is functioning properly. Initializing, a basic disk that is being converted into a dynamic disk. Missing, a dynamic disk that is corrupt, turned off, or disconnected. Not initialized, a disk that does not contain a valid signature. It's always scary to see that. Online, a basic or dynamic disk that is accessible and shows no problems. Online, in parentheses, errors, I/O errors that are detected on a dynamic disk. Offline, a dynamic disk that is corrupted or unavailable. Unreadable, a basic or dynamic disk that has experienced hardware failure, corruption, or I/O errors. Now, I have a question, and this is because the text didn't really explain. What's the difference between a basic and a dynamic disk on here? They don't really explain
it. A dynamic disk is a volume that can be grown and shrunk. You can do spanning operations on it. You can hook a whole stack of dynamic disks together. You can change how much space is allocated to the different drives, and it completely breaks compatibility with just about everything else that reads and writes to the volumes, so you don't tend to use dynamic disks too much because they're not compatible with legacy stuff and you can't read and write with file systems from other operating systems.
Okay, I suppose I got the changing part, but it was just a bit weird. Other drive status indicators might be displayed when using drives other than hard drives. Two of these are audio CD, an audio CD that is in the optical drive, no media, an optical drive or removable drive that is empty. It's lovely to have a cough button on here.
I know.
File system. Partitions are formatted with a file system. The three file systems available in Windows XP are FAT, in parentheses FAT16, FAT32, and NTFS. I don't know, to me that's still two. FAT16 and FAT32 are just, like, derivatives of the same thing, aren't they? Anyway, NTFS has greater stability and security features. For example, Windows does not display the file extensions, but this practice can cause security problems. Virus writers are able to distribute executable files disguised as non-executable files. I'm not sure whether this is anything to do with the file system or just something that Windows does regardless of what file system there is. Does Windows actually do this if you were to have it on a FAT volume, for example? Because I've been wondering this as I've been going through here.
Does Windows do what, sorry? Provide security? No.
Well, one of the things it's saying as an example is that Windows hides the file extensions and that you should turn it off.
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does hide them on FAT. Yes, it does.
Is that a feature of NTFS?
No, it's a feature of Windows itself, regardless of the file system it runs on.
Dependent, so I don't know why they put it there. But anyway, or maybe they're just saying it's an example of a security feature. I don't know. But anyway, to avoid this feature, and not only is it a security problem, but it also, for blind users, makes it really difficult to tell whether something's a file, whether it's a folder, what program's going to come up when you press enter on this file, folder, what the heck is it thing. And sighted people do have icons for these things, and they vary widely. So not only will it increase security, but it'll make things a little easier on your poor head as a blind user. So to avoid this security breach and annoyance, you should always show file extensions, and here's how you do it. Most of us have probably done this at one point or another, but here's how we do it. We select Start, Control Panel, Folder Options, and on the View tab, there's a box that says, you uncheck, it says Hide Extensions for Known File Types, and then you hit OK. It also says, note, saving files to the root directory of a C:\drive can cause organizational problems with data.
Did you hear that, Grace?
It's best practice to store data in folders created on
the
C drive.
Do not save files in the root directory of the C drive. It can cause organizational problems.
Yeah, we all do this. Okay, at least I totally have done this in the past. I've been a lot cleaner about it now.
Just move your microphone away. You're really loud.
Oh, sorry.
I think you've got amplifiers turned on for the free talks.
Yeah, you probably do. Okay. You have a lab about creating a partition in XP. Create a FAT32 formatted partition. on a disk, convert the disk to NTFS, and identify the differences between the FAT32 format and NTFS format. Now, this is the one I had a lot of fun with, Grace, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, so hint for you guys. If you have the virtual machines that these guys have put out that Kavi's using, it's a very good idea to use them because they've already kind of planned for this lab and have it so that there is some unallocated space for you to work with. If you're using your own like I did and you didn't know this, basically you'll need to add a disk in first, because what Windows says is it says, okay, you have this however big drive, 250 gig, 500 gig, 2 terabyte drive. Well, I'm going to install and I'm going to take all of it. And then you can't really easily do things like this because Windows has allocated or said, hey, I'm going to steal all of the space on this drive. And it literally took days before I realized that that was the problem. So save yourself some headaches. We had a lot of fun with that one.
Yeah, and then there was something up with the screen size or something as well with yours, which made it actually...
Yeah, that was... yeah, that... Well, I think it was more that the problem with the disk not working right, because once we got that, then it went really well.
There is a problem with disk management. If this, and this is one of the things I didn't realize, that if you have your resolution set too low, say for example you are only running at 800 by 600, a lot of the dialogues in Windows are set to fit on a larger screen, and you actually can't get at the bottom of the screen, and there is no scrollability, because we had trouble getting to those icons down the bottom because the resolution wasn't high enough. That was one of the other things we had to mess with.
That's right. Okay, so now we're going to talk about optimizing operating systems. Several procedures and tools are available to optimize the performance of an operating system. And the concepts may be the same across operating systems, but the optimization methods and procedures are different sometimes. And the example they give is that while virtual memory performs the same function on a Windows 98 and Windows XP operating system, the path to find and set virtual memory settings is different. I'm not sure why they went back that far, but anyway. You're all probably already familiar with some of the tools used to optimize Windows. Disk defragmenter is used to gather data on the hard disk that has become spread around or fragmented on the drive. Error checking allows you to check for file system errors and or fix hard drive errors such as bad sectors, so you can do both of those things. Error checking, Windows uses the program chkdsk, and either via the command line or through the graphical interface, to find and fix hard drive errors. To access it through the interface, use My Computer or Computer for Vista/7, locate the drive to be checked and open its properties dialog, and control tab over to where it's the Tools tab, or click on it, and select, there's a button that says Check Now, Error Checking Check Now. Once the error checking dialog opens, choose Scan for and Attempt Recovery of Bad Sectors. When this test is used, chkdsk automatically performs a file system check and repair as well, so you get both of them at once. Any data that is recovered is saved to files in the root directory of the disk. The CLI version of the utility has four options to check a drive for errors, and they are chkdsk with no options, displays a status report of the drive. Check disk, I'm just going to say check disk because it's easier. Check disk /F, fixes errors on the disk. Check disk /R, recovers readable information from bad sectors. Check disk /X, dismounts the volume if necessary. Check disk makes multiple passes over the disk, checking for specific criteria, and here they are. Phase 1, checking files. Check disk examines each file record in the master file table, or MFT, for consistency. By the end of this phase...
I was going to say, sad blindy yeah. moment. When you said phase 1, checking files, I'm just like, why isn't that the Eloquence voice?
Okay!
Because that's what check disk says. It says phase 1, checking files. Phase 2, checking security descriptors. Phase 3, checking indexes.
Well, and they
phase
took, 3. And they must have taken the phases straight from there, because yeah, that's what it did.
And I'm just like, why isn't that Eloquence?
Okay. Phase 1, checking files in my voice this time. Check this.
So next semester you'll have to have a soundbite of Eloquence just to confuse Carrie.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Why don't you sound like Reach?
Oh, I'm glad I don't.
I know a guy
okay,
who can, actually.
Oh, dear.
That's got to be unbelievable.
Yeah, pretty much. In phase one, checking files, CheckDisk examines each file record in the master file table, MFT, for consistency. By the end of this phase, used and available space on the volume has been identified. Phase two, checking indexes. I want to say indices, but that's not what it says here. DHK-DSK examines the MFT to ensure that every file and directory is referenced by at least one entry. Finally, CHK-DSK checks that the timestamps and file sizes are correct in the directory listing. Phase 3, checking security descriptors. CHK-DSK examines the security descriptors for files or directories, ownership information, and NTFS permissions. And that makes me think a little bit of, like, verify and repair permissions on the Mac. I don't know if they're at all similar, but that's kind of what my mind said when I read it is, oh, that's what it makes me think of. Anyway, phases 4 and 5, checking sectors. If the R option is used, CheckDisk CHKDSK makes two more passes looking for sectors that have physical damage. So those are the criteria it uses. To help optimize the hard disk and Windows, a defrag utility is provided. As files are accessed on the drive, they go from being grouped together on a disk to being scattered all over the place, and this makes it hard for the computer to find them quickly and slows Windows down because it has to go all over the place. This is because the hard drive has to search several areas on the hard drive platter to find the entire file. While this doesn't really cause a problem for just one file, this adds up when you have thousands of files all being fragmented all the time. And this is physically slowing down the drive's ability to find things because it has to go all over. And sort of when I was thinking about this today, I thought, well, it's kind of like that, if you're like the really messy person that's always messy all the time and you moved into a new apartment and you're like, okay, I'm going to clean out everything from this old apartment or this old room in my house that I, you know, old bedroom and put all new stuff in and it's not going to get messy ever again. And you think that for a while, but then eventually stuff starts going everywhere, all over your apartment, all over your house. And then when you have to rush out and you're somewhere you absolutely have to be and, oh my God, where's the parts for this outfit and I can't find this and I can't find this and you're rushing all over, that's what your computer's doing when it's fragmented. I have no idea why I came up with this analogy, but hey, I did. So I'm going to use it.
It's fantastic.
So having a defrag is sort of like having like either someone you really like or your housekeeper come in and just do a massive clean out for you and you don't have to do it. Wouldn't that be fun? So this is what your computer's doing all the time, is fragmenting all this stuff. The degree that this fragmentation occurs is going to depend on how often you have it done. The less frequently you have the defrag or the housekeeper come in, the more messy things are going to get. And let's see. To perform a defrag in XP, open My Computer or Windows Explorer, choose the drive to be defragmented, and the properties, choose the properties for it. And Defragment Now is on the Tools tab, and you'll press that to bring up the Defragment utility. To defrag in Windows Vista, the steps are the same, except that you use the computer icon instead of My Computer. And I remember from the last time we did this that you guys were saying that the Vista and 7 defrag is apparently not very good, and so I believe you had alternatives, and I'm also curious to know why you don't think it's that great. So if you guys can...
The reason it's not very good is you fire it up and it sort of sits around and goes, oh yeah, I'll defrag it for you when I think you're ready to be defragged, and I'll do it in the background and you will have no control over this unless you turn off the defragmentation service altogether. But you don't need to worry about it. I'll just do a particularly bad job over a couple of weeks. And if you have a look on things like www.mydefrag.com, there is actually an explanation of why you would want to use My Defrag instead of the Windows XP Defragmenter. I have used Defragler, although I found a couple of minor accessibility problems, which is pretty much par for the course for Piriform stuff. Has anyone else used Defragler?
I put it on, but I don't think I ever got around to actually using it.
Yeah, okay, well, interested to see what other people think of it. It does do a really good job at defragging, and one of the good things about Defragler is you can say, defragment this specific folder, and it will just defrag the files in that folder rather than the whole drive, which is somewhat useful if you're doing like an audio editing project and there's just one folder you need to be sensible. The other point I was going to make, and I didn't get to it because I didn't feel like interrupting, was when you are check disking your hard drive, your external hard drive, don't try and play music off it at the same time. That's really silly. And in fact, check disk will have a big complaint and go, this drive isn't unmounted.
Have people actually... Okay.
It's not, yeah, people have actually done that. Not me, but it's been done.
Okay.
And then they keep wondering why the check disk keeps restarting because it updates last access times and stuff.
I'm glad I was, you know, when I've done it, I thought, you know, I better just use another computer so I can still just do something else. Alrighty.
I tried using it on the C drive and using JAWS, of course, and it kept restarting. So I guess the best thing to do is just use it on the C drive, walk away from the computer. Can you tell it to unlock the C drive, or...?
No. What you do when you're doing it on the C drive is you open a command prompt and you go chkdsk /C:\f, and it says the following drive cannot be locked and chkdsk cannot obtain exclusive access to the volume. Would you like to check the volume the next time you restart? And then you say yes. Because there's too many things accessing the drive under Windows. You've got Skype, MSN Messenger, every other background service you've got.
Eventually the graphical version will offer to do that for you, but it takes a while to figure out that it needs to.
Will the results be displayed in an accessible format, or
no.
How does that work?
Of course not. It happens at boot
really
time.
You don't really even get results anymore, though. It just says, hey, I'm done. It doesn't really even tell you anymore what it did.
Well, back it sort of does, like, but, you know, if it says, you know, recovered 275 lost file fragments, and you're going to go, so I'll just go through and look at file 1 to file 275.chk. Right. You just want it to fix it.
Yeah.
The best way to test a system drive, if you have to do it and you need accessible access to it, because I realise that's going to be the next question, is to actually rip it out and stick it in a SATA dock and check it on another system, and then you will get accessible access to find out what blew up nastily. But let me assure you, if it blew up that bad, you're probably not likely to get much data back off the drive, because NTFS is not forgiving when it really goes bad.
No, I imagine it isn't. Okie dokie. Administrator, we're going to move on. Administrators can use the System Information Tool to collect and display information about local and remote computers. I've never actually tried doing it the remote way, but it explains that. The System Information Tool quickly finds information about software, drivers, hardware configurations, and computer components. The information can be used by support personnel to diagnose and troubleshoot a computer. Another program that will provide a lot of the same information is BellArc Advisor. Can also be used to provide access to similar information and more, though the free version cannot be used in organizations due to licensing restrictions, so they have a commercial version for businesses that they would prefer you use, which makes sense. But for home users, the free version is great, and this program is pretty much essential, I think, if you're just on your own. The info is displayed in an HTML page with great navigation. And it'll even grab things like your license, like some of your, like your Windows key and keys for various things, your BIOS version, and more. So have fun with BellArc Advisor. And
one small comment. It's great. Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you. It is free for non-commercial personal use. So don't install it at work unless you've got a license.
That's where I was trying to go without being so... brazen, but you just did it, thanks. That is what I was trying to say. It's great when you're doing your BIOS lab and you need to know what BIOS you have. That's what I used it for. Anyway, going back to system information, system information can be accessed through the system information option, which is located under accessories and then system tools. And you can also use, isn't it MS or sysinfo32 you can do from the command line or from the run box? There's a thing you can enter, and I think that's what it is. But you can.
I think it's just sysinfo.
I meant to check it, and I.
No, it's not. I'm not sure what it is. What'd you say was true?
I think it's actually in one of the. I think it's actually in one of the labs. And I think it's in, like, one of the chapter...
I'm not sure which one it is. I was just saying that system information has gotten slightly less useless in 7.
Oh, it's MS Info 32. I just did it. I just remembered that. So if you really want to get into it quickly, you can do run or whatever MS Info 32. Okay. It may be necessary to send a file containing all of the information about a computer to another technician that system information has, or to a help desk. To export a system information file, click File, Export, and type the name of the file, and choose a location, and click Save. This seems to take forever. Every time I've seen this go, it takes for way longer than you'd think it should. And I don't really understand why, but that's kind of how it goes. The system information tool in Windows XP also provides quick access to many other tools, and I'm not actually sure how to find these, but I'll have to take a look at some point. And here they are. NetDiagnostics. This tool runs a variety of network tests to troubleshoot network-related problems. System Restore. This tool creates or loads a restore point for restoring the computer's system files and settings. Well, there's another way to get to that. File Signature Verification Utility. This tool checks for system files that are not digitally signed. Never seen that. DirectX tool. This tool reports detailed information about DirectX components that are installed on your computer. Dr. Watson. This tool debugs Windows to help diagnose program errors. I've actually seen Dr. Watson error, like this program has performed an illegal operation, but I've never actually tried go looking for it and see what it does.
I've seen Dr. Watson perform the illegal operation, which always frightens.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I have used Dr. Watson, actually. There was a time where I was getting this error from my antivirus software that was throwing up something, and I actually went in and found out what DLL it was and tracked down that it was one of the network DLLs and figured out it was actually a problem with my network configuration, but that's just me.
My question is, why did they make
Why is it called Dr. Watson? Because it's elementary, my dear Watson.
Yes, it is. He never said that. That was
no. He never said that.
For the record, he never said that.
Yes, he did never say that.
Just like the games afoot, and in Star Trek, beam me up, Scotty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Conan Doyle was having a little fun there. To view the information from a remote computer, and I've never tried this, but I might have to try this. Follow these steps with a computer in my house, of course. Choose View and then Remote Computer from the View menu. 2, choose Remote Computer on the network. 3, type the name of the computer that you want to view and click OK. I wonder if you can browse to it. I don't know. I'll have to play with that sometime. The remote desktop protocol.
Actually, the thing you've got to watch out with that... The thing you got to watch out with that, guys, is whilst it's a really nifty feature and it's really great, and yes, you can pull the information off remote computers, is it worth mentioning that remote access to the registry is a hideous security risk, and you should probably turn it off after you've played with SysInfo on a remote machine.
Just a bit.
So is that something that's always on and you have to get, like, people
No,
from
that's
doing
how it's not you... usually.
Yeah, it's on. Yeah, it's on. Yeah, it's on.
What?
Read-only access is usually on.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Is that port usually blocked by default, like if you're behind a NAT router?
I'm not sure.
I guess that's not as much of a security risk if it's read-only.
Yeah, but you still might not see people. You still probably don't want people looking at your stuff, because there's a lot in there. All right, moving on.
It's now gone 11, by the way, but just...
Yeah, I just told...
Okay. Let's see. Let's do one more. The remote desktop protocol allows you to use an application such as remote desktop or remote assistance to connect to another computer. These applications allow you to view the screen and control the computer's mouse and keyboard as though you were local to that computer. The remote desktop protocol is also used to operate computers that are connected to the network but do not have a monitor, mouse, or keyboard. And the remote desktop protocol is accessible if the client and server computer have whichever screen reader, JAWS or Window Eyes, on them, and it's enabled and authorized so that you can do that. So yes, you have to have the authorization from Freedom if that's the route you're going. And this is not the same as Tandem or Ceratex RIM. Those are two other things. And a remote assistance is not accessible at all, am I correct? even if you have that set up, like with the JAWS and stuff, I don't think you can do that, correct? Okay, I don't know.
What's the question?
The question is, if it's talking about remote desktop, but we can use that if we have like the JAWS authorized, if we've given them that, or if we have the WindowEyes and the server and client have it. But remote assistance is not doable, is that correct? That's the computer thing.
No, I don't
I'm
think
pretty
so.
Sure that's not doable, the built into Windows
no,
solution.
That's why we have Tandem.
To access the remote desktop program, use the following path.
No, only remote
start
desktop
all programs. Yeah, that's what I figured. Start all programs, accessories, remote desktop connection. And remote assistance uses the remote desktop protocol to allow another user to connect to your computer, see your computer screen, and chat over a network. With your permission, the remote user can control your computer.
It's a Windows laptop.
As we said, this is...
We can't use it, and also it needs to either have an invitation sent via email, so if the problem's with their email, you're out of luck.
Yeah, I was just going
to
mention that.
And also, or Windows Messenger. I think you can do it under Windows Live Messenger as well, but I'm not sure.
You can.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you should want to access the remote assistance in Windows XP, use Start, Help and Support, Invite a Friend to Connect to Your Computer with Remote Assistance, and then Invite Someone to Help You. And in Windows Vista, you go to Start, Help and Support, Use Windows Remote Assistance to Get Help from a Friend or Offer Help. Invite someone you trust to help you. I think it's interesting that the wording's changed there, but I like it. An email invitation must be sent to another user to allow them to connect and control your computer. After the recipient has received the invitation, the recipient can see your desktop and help you. Okay, I think we're going to pick up with virtual memory tomorrow.
Virtual memory, okay.
So that's where, and I'll make a note to myself somewhere. So that's
a couple, just put a star there.
Things.
Yeah.
You can only use remote desktop on Pro.
That is correct. Yep. I forgot to mention that.
And it didn't mention it either. Yeah, it should. I guess I just assume everyone's using Pro, but it's a really dumb thing to assume.
The curriculum says you need XP Pro for all of this anyway, so meh.
It is in the table that compares the different editions of Pro and Home and stuff. That actually, we kind of took that out. If you want to look at that, you can. But that is in there that Home does not support it.
Isn't remote assistance in Home? Remote assistance is in Home. But
we're talking about desktop.
Home, but remote desktop is not.
Remote desktop is in Pro, and I think it's in Home Premium of 7 and better.
Probably.
Oh, no, it's only in Professional.
Yeah,
it's not in Home Premium. Yeah, it's only in Professional. Okay, yeah. I've just got mumbled sleepy confirmation from the other end of the house that it's only in Professional.
Okay.
Overall, I'd say that's a good thing. But
who did that come from?
Yeah, the other thing is, because you were talking about Dr. Watson earlier, and it reminds me, there's a couple of really great, and I can't remember their names, which is very useful, it's like BS Viewer or something, that will actually let you view the contents of a blue screen error, and it's accessible like in Windows, so if you get one of those and that restarts a computer and you want to know what's causing your blue screens, and you can get one of these and it will read the mini dump. And you will be able to tell
that would
what,
be cool.
You know, driver
wow, if you
is
find that,
it. Yeah,
your homework is to find it and put it on Discuss as your homework.
I've graduated.
Yeah, awesome.
It's really useful. It is really awesome and useful.
Yeah.
It's your post-grad research work.
I'm sure if you just look on Google for a blue screen viewer, you'll be able to find a plethora of these. But yeah, it's incredibly useful because I figured out once that it was like the problem was with the network stack and it was driving me insane. My computer would just randomly just blue screen like every 10 minutes and I could not figure why. And it was, oh my god, I was going absolutely bonkers about it.
It's very important when fixing your computer not to get personally invested and involved in your computer's little wibblies for blood pressure reasons. I've been informed that it's any version better than Home Premium, so we're talking about Ultimate, Business, and Professional has got Remote Desktop in it. And if you have WindowEyes, you get the support for free. Enterprise, yes. If you're using WindowEyes, you get it for free. And if you're using JAWS, you don't.
It. as an option as well. I don't know what it, how it fits into the price.
That'll help five people, from what I can tell.
Yeah, I know, but I just thought I'd throw it out there.
It's the one that Balm put out, and it's like, and if it ever gains popularity, people will start caring. But it's probably, as I said, it's probably got like five people that use it. Yeah. It's sort of one of those market things. It's a bit like
if I bet if I understood the philosophy that they were coming at it when they wrote it, I'd be fine. But it's one of these screen readers that's got 85,000 different modes and lots of keys that you that are really harder than average to remember, and it's crazy. I played with it.
Yeah, with JAWS you can get it, but yeah, you need like $200. I don't believe NVDA does it at all.
No.
No, it doesn't. Not yet, anyway. I'm sure if we gave them like $10,000, they'd look into it. Yeah. It's a money-driven thing. There is a remote access solution for system access. I don't know whether it actually does remote desktop out of the box.
Well, what else would it do?
Yeah, I think they've got their own thing.
Yeah, it's a thing called RIM or something. Remote Incident Manager.
Yeah, Remote Incident Management or Manager, yeah.
Unfortunate name for the technology, but there you have it.
Well, yeah. There's RAM as well.
They
so
made it. Yeah.
RIM and RAM.
Yeah. Did the recording go away?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, even one of their support people said, "Yeah, we're kind of a kinky company here with all these things." And he was a sales guy, actually.